hello and welcome to Flick Fix on 99.9 KXRW. This show is going to take you on an unforgettable adventure through the silver screen. I'm your guide, Austin Reed. Join me as we delve deep into the realms of Hollywood's finest creations and hidden gems along the way. Movies have the power to transport us to incredible worlds, evoke a wide range of emotions, and ignite our imaginations like nothing else. They capture our hearts, challenge our minds, and provide us with a much-needed escape from the ordinary. Flick Fix is here to celebrate the magic of cinema, to honor the art of storytelling, and to light up a passionate flame within each and every one of you. So grab your popcorn, dim the lights, and get ready to immerse yourself in a world of lights, camera, and action. Welcome back to Flick Fix, the show where new releases meet old favorites. This week, we've got a full plate of movies to dig into. First up, Michael Shanks makes his directorial debut with Together, a movie that mixes relationship drama with some seriously grotesque body horror. Then, Liam Neeson trades in his usual tough guy act for slapstick in The Naked Gun. Yes, the franchise is back, and it's as ridiculous as ever. And then we'll be unpacking Zach Cregger's latest mystery horror, Weapons, which might just be one of the most unsettling films of this year. But we don't stop at the new stuff. We are rewinding to the mid-2010s to revisit Doug Liman's Edge of Tomorrow. It's got Tom Cruise, Emily Blunt, and a time loop twist that still holds up today. Stick around, you won't want to miss it. Together is a supernatural body horror film written and directed by Michael Shanks in his directorial debut. Real-life couple Dave Franco and Allison Brie star as Tim and Millie, a pair who relocate in the countryside only to encounter a mysterious force, one that doesn't just haunt them, but begins to grotesquely reshape their very bodies. I've always loved horror films that deliver the scares, but also go deeper, and Together absolutely fits that mold. While the supernatural threat is chilling, what really pulled me in was the emotional tension between the two leads. Tim is an ambitious musician with dreams of making it big, while Millie, a grounded English teacher, prefers a more settled life. Their relationship is already teetering, and the move to a remote new home only amplifies their disconnect. You can feel the uncertainty in every glance and every argument. Are they truly in love or just afraid of being alone? Franco and Brie's chemistry gives the story weight, making their relationship struggles as gripping as the horror itself. That emotional core is what allows the horror elements to sneak in so efficiently. This isn't a film that relies solely on cheap jump scares, although there are jump scares and some are pretty effective. They're used sparingly and often with purpose, not just to jolt the audience, but to heighten the tension that's already simmering beneath the surface. The real strength lies in how the horror gradually entwines with the relationship drama. Even when the scary moments take their time to build, I didn't mind. I was already deeply invested in these characters and the emotional unraveling at the heart of it all. But once the horror does arrive, it gets gnarly fast. There are some genuinely stomach-churning sequences that had me wincing in disgust, but in the best way. What's impressive is that the film never loses its sense of humor. Even at its most grotesque, there are moments of dry, surprising comedy that keep it from becoming overwhelming. It's a rare balance that works in the film's favor. Gross, but fun. That said, Together doesn't fully stick the landing. While the setup is strong and the premise compelling, the second half doesn't quite build on the momentum that it creates. It flirts with some fascinating body horror concepts, but never fully commits to exploring them in depth. I found myself wanting more. More escalation, more madness, more payoff. It might be that I've been spoiled by last year's The Substance, a film that pushed body horror to extreme, unforgettable places. Compared to that, Together feels like it holds back just when it should be going for broke. Still, even with its shortcomings, Together is a bold, engaging debut that blends emotional drama with visceral horror in a way that's well worth experiencing, even if you're looking for something a little different in the genre. It may not completely reshape the landscape of body horror, but it definitely leaves somewhat of a mark. I'd give it a solid 7 out of 10. The Naked Gun is a 2025 American action crime comedy directed by Akiva Schaffer, who also wrote the screenplay. Acting as a legacy sequel to The Naked Gun 33 and a Third, The Final Insult, it's the fourth entry in the long-running Naked Gun franchise. This time around, Liam Neeson steps into the spotlight supported by Pamela Anderson. The story follows the son of the iconic Lieutenant Frank Drebin as he tries to live up to his father's legendary reputation while attempting to save Police Squad from being shut down. Now, I'll just say it. I feel like big budget comedies are finally starting to crawl their way back into theaters after being practically extinct for the last decade. And honestly, I want that trend to continue because movie theaters need it badly. In recent years, most comedies have quietly shuffled onto streaming platforms, maybe trending for a week before vanishing into the algorithm abyss. But The Naked Gun is a type of movie that belongs in a theater. Why? Because it's single-minded in its mission, to make people laugh. And when you're sitting in a packed auditorium surrounded by strangers all cracking up together, that shared laughter is an experience streaming can't replicate. It's something that I feel has been missing for a long while. If you know the style of David and Jerry Zucker, the original minds behind this franchise, you know the formula. Deadpan line deliveries stacked with rapid-fire visual gags, absurd spoofs, and jokes crammed into every corner of the screen. This new installment embraces that DNA proudly. Jokes are everywhere, layered so thickly you might miss a couple on your first watch. This film is almost like a time machine back to the comedies of the 80s and 90s, where sincerity wasn't the point and seriousness was tossed out the window. You don't come to a Naked Gun movie for heartwarming character arcs. You come to see how ridiculous the next gag can get, and on that front, it's a return to form. That being said, if you're looking for something truly memorable beyond the laughs, this movie probably won't scratch that itch. The focus is on comedy above all else, which means the story gets pushed to the sidelines. The plot follows pretty predictable beats, and I found myself wishing the film had taken a few bigger risks, especially given that this was made for a wide theatrical release. Imagine how much more powerful the comedy could have been if it had been paired with a story that actually had some real stakes or unexpected turns. Instead, the narrative just kind of floats along, acting as a delivery system for jokes rather than building to anything impactful. Don't get me wrong, The Naked Gun is hilarious. It's a film that knows exactly what it is and doesn't try to be anything else, which is admirable in its own right. But part of me wonders if the franchise could have gone that extra mile, offering not just laughs, but something to hold on to once the credits roll. As it stands, you'll have a great time in the theater. You'll laugh a lot, but you probably won't be thinking much about it afterwards. My score for this one? 6 out of 10. Alright, let's talk about Weapons. This one is a mystery horror film written, directed, co-produced, and even co-composed by Zach Cregger. This guy really had his hands all over this project. The cast is stacked too. Josh Brolin, Julia Garner, Austin Abrams, Benedict Wong, and Amy Madigan. The plot is built around a really eerie premise. 17 kids from the same classroom suddenly vanish on the exact same night at the exact same time. And it's not like they all decided to run away. No, it feels like they were pulled out of the world by something unseen. Now, if Krieger's name sounds familiar, there are a couple reasons why. You might have seen his first film, Barbarian, which was absolutely wild and blew up in 2022. Or, if you go back further, you might remember him from the sketch comedy troupe The Whitest Kids You Know in the 2000s. Either way, I think it's safe to call him a director to watch. He's 2 for 2 now, and both times he's managed to write and direct stories that feel unpredictable in the best way possible. Like Barbarian, the structure here is pretty unique. Instead of a straight narrative, Weapons plays out almost like a novel written in chapters. Each chapter shifts to a different character's perspective. At first, it feels fractured. You only get bits and pieces of the bigger picture. But as the film keeps jumping around, those fragments start to line up, and suddenly you're seeing how all these storylines connect. Small details you didn't think mattered end up becoming really important, and the characters who at first seem confident or even intimidating end up looking very different once the story shifts into their perspective. It's that shifting point of view that keeps the movie so entertaining. You're constantly learning something new, but you're also being thrown into some seriously twisted turns. And here's the fun part. Krieger doesn't just stick to one tone. The movie plays around with genres like it's nothing. One minute you're laughing at a perfectly timed joke, and the next minute you're in the middle of a genuinely creepy sequence. And it works. That shouldn't be a surprise coming from a guy with comedy roots. Think about it. Good comedy and good horror both rely on the same thing, catching you off guard. Both are about timing and surprise, and Weapons nails that balance. The humor feels sharp, but when the scares kick in, they're intense. Now, I do have to bring up one criticism. The movie is not airtight. There are some plot holes, plenty of unanswered questions, and a few character relationships that feel underdeveloped. Sometimes it even feels a little bloated, like it's trying to do more than it really needs to. There were definitely moments that had me asking why, and never getting a satisfying answer. But the thing is, none of that really ruins the experience. In fact, it's almost part of the charm. Even with those rough edges, this is such an engaging film that I already want to rewatch it just to pick up on stuff I missed. And honestly, when a horror movie leaves you thinking about it long after it's over, that's usually a pretty good sign. Brilliant stuff. I'm giving this film an 8.5 out of 10. Alright, it's time to take a little break. But when we get back, we're going to be covering Edge of Tomorrow. But did you know that this little film was not an original Hollywood idea? It actually started as a Japanese novel based on a little video game trend that the author noticed. You've been listening to Flick Fix on 99.9 KXRW.
KXRW programming is made possible by partners like Buckley & Associates, attorneys at law, helping injured victims seek the justice they deserve for over 40 years. Licensed in Washington State. Our diverse team speaks over 7 languages, making your rights more accessible and easier to understand. Learn more at BuckleyLaw.net. Again, that's BuckleyLaw.net. Buckley & Associates. We speak your language.
Programming like this is made possible by support from High Five Cannabis, your local cannabis connection in Vancouver and Stevenson, Washington. High Five offers flower, concentrates, edibles, tinctures, topicals, and more. Whether you're new to cannabis or know what you need, their staff is available to assist. If you go to highfivecannabis.com, spelled H-I-G-H, the number 5, cannabis.com, you can learn about their specials like Munchy Monday, Senior Tuesdays, Waxy Wednesdays, and Loyalty Thursdays. Again, that's highfivecannabis.com.
Support for KXRW comes from Kindred Vancouver in downtown Vancouver, Washington. Kindred is a community-focused general store offering bulk refillery options and supplies for sustainable, do-it-yourself living. With a focus on reducing waste and supporting clean, mindful lifestyles, Kindred helps individuals incorporate low-impact choices into daily life. More information is at kindredvancouver.com.
Welcome back. You are listening to Flick Fix on 99.9 KXRW. Big budget science fiction films rarely come easy, and Edge of Tomorrow is proof of just how bumpy the road from page to screen can be. The movie that eventually paired Tom Cruise and Emily Blunt in a time loop war epic went through countless rewrites, last-minute shakeups, and even mud-soaked sets before it reached theaters. But the story begins almost a decade earlier, not in Hollywood, but in Japan. Oh, and moderate spoilers ahead. Let's begin. Before Tom Cruise ever put on a battle suit, the original story called All You Need Is Kill began as a Japanese light novel with a clever twist on an old idea. Written by Hiroshi Sakurazaka, it was first published on December 18, 2004. The seed of the story didn't come from literature or film, but from video games. Sakurazaka had once read an online post from a gamer describing the odd rhythm of repeatedly dying, restarting, and slowly getting better with each try. That cycle of trial and error inspired him to imagine a soldier trapped in a similar loop, forced to fight, die, and fight again, like a playable character being replayed over and over. Before writing, Sakurazaka also looked to other works in the time loop tradition, most notably Harold Ramis' Groundhog Day. But while that film turned its endless cycle into comedy, Sakurazaka envisioned something darker and more relentless, combining the mechanics of gaming with the brutality of war. The result was a novel that felt both familiar and weirdly fresh. Fast forward a few years, and the book's originality caught the eye of Hollywood. In 2009, Viz Media published All You Need Is Kill in North America as part of the launch lineup for his Haikusoro imprint, designed to bring Japanese sci-fi to Western audiences. It was one of the four novels that kicked off the line, and producer Irwin Stoff quickly took notice. Rather than pitching the project straight to a major studio with a basic outline, the team made an unusual move. They decided to commission a full spec script first. Stoff approached writer Dante Harper, sending him the novel. Harper admitted that the book was too complex to adapt easily, but even without a guarantee of payment, he decided to take the risk. He spent 8 painstaking months cutting through the novel's density to create something cinematic. The gamble paid off. In August 2010, Warner Brothers purchased Harper's draft in a $3 million deal, and Doug Liman had signed on to direct. Harper's script even landed on that year's blacklist, Hollywood's unofficial roll call of the best unproduced screenplays. But just like the novel's looping protagonist, the script itself was doomed to die and be reborn again and again. By June 2011, Warner Brothers brought in Joby Harold for a rewrite. That September, the studio set its sights on Brad Pitt for the lead. He passed, so they turned to Tom Cruise. Once Cruise came aboard in December 2011, the role was reshaped around him. Emily Blunt joined the cast a few months later in April 2012, solidifying the film's central pairing. But the real roller coaster came just before filming. 6 months out, Doug Liman scrapped two-thirds of Harper's original script. Jez and John Henry Butterworth stepped in for rewrites, followed by Simon Kinberg. And then, only 8 weeks before cameras rolled, Christopher McQuarrie was brought in at Cruise's suggestion. McQuarrie, fresh from directing Jack Reacher, immediately saw the heart of the project, the balance between bleak, war-torn storytelling and sharp, ironic humor. Previous drafts had leaned darker, but Cruise pushed for levity, comparing his character's endless deaths to Wile E. Coyote's cartoon disasters. With the script finally settled, production rolled forward at Warner Brothers Studio Leavesden, just outside London. Not everything about the shoot was blockbuster scale. The opening sequence with Cruise was shot in director Doug Liman's editing room, with Cruise handling his own hair and makeup. Liman later joked that it may be the most independent thing I've ever done. On the other end of the spectrum, the massive beach battle was built entirely indoors. Liman originally wanted to shoot on location, but the production instead constructed a sprawling artificial beach on the Leavesden lot, ringed by green screens. Visual effects artists later expanded the background with footage from Saunton Sands in North Devon, crafting a look inspired by World War II coastal invasions like Normandy and Dunkirk. Principal photography officially began on October 1st, 2012, and immediately ran into turbulence. On the second day, Liman reportedly scrapped everything filmed on day one, unnerving producers wary of his free-form, workshoppy directing style. The beach scenes, meant to last 2 weeks, ballooned into nearly 3 months of shooting. The shoot quickly became a test of endurance. Liman worked with two full crews, filming 7 days a week and adding 20 extra days to the schedule. Continuity became a nightmare. The entire movie was set in a single day, but Britain's unpredictable weather refused to cooperate. Meanwhile, the indoor beach set turned into a mud pit, forcing visual effects artists to digitally clean the sand and surf. If the muddy indoor beach set was one test of endurance, the other was the film's iconic battle suits. Production designer Oliver Schall and his team developed multiple concepts for the powered exoskeleton. Their starting point wasn't fantasy, but reality. They looked closely at military prototypes and DARPA-funded exoskeleton programs, then spun those into designs that felt futuristic yet grounded. The day-to-day logistics, however, were grueling. Each suit required four crew members just to help an actor get in and out. Early on, it took Tom Cruise half an hour to be strapped into his armor and another half hour to get out again. Eventually, the crew streamlined the process until it could be done under 30 seconds. Between takes, though, even the strongest bodies needed relief. To spare the actors from collapsing under the weight, chains were rigged to iron frames that could literally hoist Cruise, Blunt, and the others off the ground, letting the armor hang while the performers caught their breath. After months of rewrites, mud-soaked sets, and actors literally hanging from chains in 100-pound battle suits, Edge of Tomorrow marched forward towards release. Critics responded warmly, praising its inventive twist on the time loop formula and the chemistry between its leads. The box office told a more complicated story. Edge of Tomorrow opened lower than hoped in the US, weighed down in part by what analysts described as confusing marketing. Was the film called Edge of Tomorrow? Was it Live, Die, Repeat? The muddled branding didn't help. Internationally, however, the movie performed far stronger, eventually pulling in over $370 million worldwide. While not a runaway smash, it was enough to justify its reputation as a critical success with a loyal fan base. Over time, the film found an even bigger audience in the home market, where the Live, Die, Repeat branding became so dominant that many viewers assumed it was the actual title. As word of mouth spread, the movie's reputation grew, from a quirky Tom Cruise vehicle into one of the most beloved sci-fi action films of the decade. Its blend of originality, humor, and sheer spectacle helped it stand out in a crowded blockbuster landscape. Alrighty then, now it's time for a more personal take. The first time that I saw Edge of Tomorrow was in college, right after I moved away from home. Back then, I thought it was a solid movie, gave it a mental thumbs up, and moved on. Fast forward to this past week, and I finally watched it again from beginning to end, and honestly, it holds up better than I remembered. Here's my main take though. Without the time loop gimmick, this movie would not stand out. We've seen decades of sci-fi action flicks filled with aliens, mechs, and explosions, and not much in the basic setup is new. But that live-die-repeat hook? It's perfected here. The story doesn't underuse it or lean too hard on it. The pacing hits a sweet spot where repetition feels fresh, inventive, and most importantly, fun. What makes it work so well is how the loop raises the stakes. At first, it's almost comical watching Tom Cruise's character die over and over in bizarre ways, but then the story smartly pivots. He learns to use the cycle to his advantage, memorizing enemy patterns and unraveling the mystery of the alien invaders. The repetition never drags because the filmmakers are clever with how they show it. Sharp cuts, quick shifts, little reminders that yes, he's died 100 times by now. And then, just when you think the gimmick might run its course, the movie delivers a brilliant twist. Cruise's character gets a blood transfusion and loses the ability to reset. Suddenly, he's down to one life, one shot. That moment recharges the tension completely. Bravo, writers. Now, I will say the last 20 minutes lean too heavily on CGI spectacle for my taste. It becomes a bit of a digital fireworks show, all flash and chaos, but thankfully it pulls itself together and closes in a satisfying way. Overall, Edge of Tomorrow is a reminder of how good a so-called original blockbuster can be when it's firing on all cylinders. It takes familiar sci-fi tropes, adds a clever twist, and executes it with confidence. Watching it again also gave me a bittersweet feeling. This came out right before streaming really started reshaping how we watch movies, and it feels like one of the last great examples of that classic summer blockbuster energy. The kind that's big, bold, and best experienced on a big screen with a crowd. A strange, nostalgic feeling indeed. For me, revisiting it years later was a reminder that originality in Hollywood doesn't always come from inventing something brand new. Sometimes it's about taking an old idea, looping it back around, and finding a way to make it feel alive again. Edge of Tomorrow did just that. And that's why it still lives, dies, and repeats in the conversation today. And that's going to wrap up this episode of Flick Fix. We've covered body horror, slapstick comebacks, and mystery chills, but our spotlight film, Edge of Tomorrow, really says it all. Just like Tom Cruise waking up every day to fight another battle, I'll keep coming back each month with more reviews, more deep dives, and hopefully fewer alien invasions. If you enjoyed today's show and want to help keep independent radio alive, consider donating to KXRW. Your support keeps programs like Flick Fix on the air, and it makes a huge difference to the station as a whole. Just head to kxrw.fm and click donate. I'm Austin. You've been listening to Flick Fix on 99.9 KXRW. Thanks for listening, and tune in next time.